Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Sheena Ashley is Vice President of the Center on Nonprofits and Philanthropy at the Urban Institute. For more than 20 years, the Center has been a critical resource for credible, nonpartisan, and accessible data and insights on nonprofit and philanthropic activity in society. In addition to policy research, the Center provides technical assistance and philanthropic advisory services to advance more effective and equitable nonprofit and philanthropic practice. Before joining the Institute, Dr. Ashley held academic positions at the Maxwell School, which is located on the Syracuse University campus, but is the Maxwell School, and at Georgia State University, where she taught courses on the nonprofit sector and advanced a research agenda on grant-making effectiveness and nonprofit management. And finally, at the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Atlanta Civic Site, she was Director of Research and Policy and developed innovative tools for community engagement in performance and measurement. But most importantly, in addition to bringing all that experience and amazing research, Dr. Ashley brings a keen eye on the field. This is what she does. She watches what we do and how we do it. We've asked her to talk to us today about how philanthropy is changing and what she and her colleagues are learning, both about individual giving and institutional philanthropy. She'll also share her insights on charitable giving, the practice of equitable grant making, and place-based investment grant making. And she's going to do all of this in just 30 minutes. So I'm eager to hear what she has to say. I know you are too. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sheena Ashley to the stage.
Now let me welcome all of you to the start of your GIH 2019. This is really exciting. You've all come here to learn new, bold ways to advance your work, and I am so delighted to have just a little bit of time, 30 minutes, with you this evening. What I want to do is share three areas of research that my team has been working on. And then I'm going to share some insights for what I think that work means for the way you practice your grant making. But before I get into all that, I want to first acknowledge and celebrate the fact that all of you have already started on a journey to make your grant making more effective and also to have it advance equity. So congratulations on starting that journey, and I'm happy to just be fueling that a little bit more. But even as we have made progress, we must all still reckon with the fact that many of the inequities and challenges that we seek to address are widening. And in some ways, it really still feels a little insurmountable. And that the threatening opportunity of our time is to find bold new ways to harness the disruptive forces of technological innovation, climate events, and global economic pressures into possibilities for a more equitable future for everyone. But that means we cannot get complacent with just doing a little bit better every year. Our missions in this moment are far too urgent. Now to the research. The first research area that I want to focus on looks at changing patterns in charitable giving. You're all aware of the annual Giving USA reports. And every year since the recession, we've been celebrating banner years in giving. The past report said $286 billion, and I expect the report that comes out next week will still continue to rise. So, Sheena, if giving is going up, what's to be concerned about? Well, this top-line story is masking some significant shifts that I think we are not paying enough attention to in institutional philanthropy. Most significant to me is that the number of Americans who report giving to charitable organizations is steadily declining. And I know, before you say, it's those millennials and those young people who haven't learned to give, it's not them. It's you and me. Now, what this chart does not say is that Americans are less generous. It's pointing out that they're choosing not to give to charitable organizations. And in fact, a lot of this decline is explained by the fact that donors are shifting their giving to 501c4s and other political giving. They're choosing to do person-to-person giving for more direct impact. And many see conscious consumption or purchasing socially responsible goods as a clear substitute for charitable giving. In a nutshell, donors are seeking impact through forms of giving that are not intermediated by charitable organizations. So what explains this growth in giving, the big $286 billion number, when we are seeing decline in participation? We're more wealthy donors. And it's true that with growing wealth around the world, that the philanthropic marketplace is becoming much more dynamic and it's growing. But two, what's different is that high net worth individuals are also choosing different structures to pursue their philanthropy. They're giving through donor advised funds, LLCs, and also through C4s. All forms of giving that don't have the requirement of payout that foundations do. Seems to me, like a researcher, that pie is getting bigger. To nonprofits on the ground, that does not bear out in their experience. And so why should all this matter to you? One word, sustainability. Think about it. Foundations giving is intermediated through charitable giving. It's almost a rule, it's kind of the law. And if all the other funders are moving away from intermediated charitable giving, who will be there to sustain the impact that you are making with your grantee partners today? Who's going to carry on that work? But I think there's also a play for foundations to minimize some of the risks. Bring individuals and some of these new funders along. Okay, historically, that's a little bit of a naive statement. We've come to think of institutional philanthropy as strategic, managed, highly informed, right? We think about the evidence. And we tend to characterize individual giving as somehow checkbook, warm glow, and reactive. But today, as your colleagues who are running community foundations will tell you, that's no longer the case. Many donors who have opted not to pursue the traditional foundation form still want to lean on longstanding foundations for inspiration and guidance. Here's an example. Co-Impact, which is housed at the Rockefeller Foundation and is also backed by other foundations, was created as a platform to link high net worth donors to foundations. And there are other examples of foundations creating matching programs to connect new donors to their grantee partners. Both of these cases show that if we think creatively, we can actually do something about this trend. Now I'm going to turn to the next area of research, equitable grant making. Over the past year and a half, my team has had the privilege of using some re-granting funds provided to us by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to test some of the strategies that are being advanced in the field as best practices for equitable grant making. And by equity in this context, we mean that the opportunity to compete for grant awards is more accessible to organizations of varying size and capacity, and ultimately, that those who receive grant funding are more representative of the wide swath of organizations in our communities. Put simply, equitable grant making means philanthropy beyond the privileged few. Now, why is this kind of outcome important? Okay, you heard that I'm a recovering stats professor. So I want you to call to mind something you might have heard in stats class called the Pareto distribution. And that says that 80% of the resources will be held by 20% of the population, right? We sometimes call it the 80-20 rule. And we've observed this distribution in many natural phenomena. And it becomes a useful baseline so that if you want to see what would naturally occur, you think the breakdown would be something like 80-20. But I want you to observe the distribution in the charitable sector. We have 5% of charitable organizations controlling 87% of the resources. Not 80-20, 87-5. This is far from a natural distribution. Now, scholars point to two major reasons for this trend. One, the combination of an increase in government contracting and the shift to strategic philanthropy, which have both created competitive environments where more well-resourced organizations have a clear advantage. And the other reason is the inability of mid-sized nonprofits to recover post-recession. As a sector, we celebrated that we didn't have as many organizations to close during the recession. But what we missed was that a lot of those organizations decreased in size and have not found on-ramps to recover that growth. And so with that loss, what we have really lost is pathways for executive leadership development and right-sized organizations for innovation and growth as a result of this not-so-natural distribution that we've created. But now, with an understanding of these dynamics, we've observed that many foundations are starting to rethink the way they do their grant-making practice so that they're not contributing to furthering this trend. And so we decided, let's create an evidence base around this. And so with that regranting, we've been testing practices. And here's what we're learning. It's really exciting work. I love doing experiments. First, I want you to think about the grant-making process on a spectrum, from awareness to selection. People need to know that the grant opportunity exists, and then it goes all the way through the various parts of the machinery to the selection that you're making. At the awareness stage, we're finding that grant-making through intermediaries is a pretty successful strategy, especially when it's coupled with lots of outreach and deliberate targeting of potential applicants. We also find that having an LOI stage and offering things like video submissions of applications really does help to attract a more diverse pool of applicants. But we also learned that when you're trying to move applicants from that LOI stage to full application, that things like webinars, which we all are guilty of hosting, are actually not that effective. It's only boosting the capacity of the well-resourced organizations that much more and leaving the lower-resourced organizations behind. And the big shocker for us, and this is where we just did not expect this, is that adopting more participatory processes and even blind review do not increase the selection of a more diverse pool of grant recipients. The more well-resourced organizations were still in our tests more likely to be selected, even when we added bonus points for equity considerations. Now, we are still conducting research to understand these initial findings, but what I want you to take away from these findings is that just tinkering with your selection process may not be enough to reach a more representative set of organizations in your grantee mix. What we are starting to see, though, is that deliberate technical assistance to help organizations remain competitive all the way through the grant process could be a key strategy to get there. But this requires a shift in your thinking. It's not enough to simply provide opportunities for organizations to compete. You have to take responsibility to build capacity for organizations to be competitive. Now to the last area of research, place-based impact investing. And now this area of research moves us from the grant-making side over to the investing side. Our research on place-based impact investing has specifically focused on understanding the landscape of models and practices as this newish field matures. And I know a number of you in the audience have been in our interview pool, and we've talked to many of you and watched your models. And through this work, we have had the opportunity to observe lots more models all around the country. Let me give you two examples of place-based impact investing initiatives. The first and probably most well-known is Benefit Chicago. In this case, you have a couple of foundations that came together to back an investment note that is designed to encourage other high net worth and everyday investors to invest with them in their community, bringing others along. And they provide resources for technical assistance so that entrepreneurs of all backgrounds have the potential to compete for the investment, building capacity. The other example, not too far from here, I'm really excited and fascinated by this one because it was designed intentionally to give low and moderate income individuals an opportunity to invest in their own community as a response to gentrification pressures. It's called Plaza 122 in Portland, Oregon, and it is an initiative of Mercy Corps. Here, we have foundation investment that created an opportunity for high net worth individuals and low and moderate income individuals to make an investment into building this plaza. And as a requirement for participation, the community members were provided with financial coaching and also other forms of asset building services that built their capacity. Again, we have bringing others along and building their capacity. As I'm hoping you can see by now, the two ways that I'm asking philanthropy to shift its thinking in the grant making, you're already doing in the place-based impact investing work. And what I'm hoping is that we can take the kind of thinking that comes really natural to us on the investment side and apply that same kind of mindset on the charitable giving side. I know what you're thinking, two different worlds, how dare I say we think the same across them. But do you know what I think? I think that there's something about the investment side that forces us to think about risk and return, right? It's so natural for us to think that we want to minimize our risk by bringing in co-investors into the capital stack, and that we want to ensure our return by building a healthy pipeline of investable opportunities along the way. But what I want you to take away from the major trends that I showed you is that there is now a risk-return calculation happening on the grant-making side. The trends in charitable giving suggest that we are at risk of losing the sustainability of our impact as other donors move away from intermediated giving. And our equitable grant-making research shows us that the return of the kind of impact that we really want, impact that builds power and allows those who are closest to the problems to be part of designing those solutions, requires us to take really seriously our obligation to build capacity for a robust pipeline of competitive applicants. So, I am asking you to think about whether you need to make changes to your core ways of working to bring this kind of thinking into your grant making. Again, many of you are already doing this. We know how to do this, but we need to think a little bit more creatively about how we might do this in our grant making. Question, please.
My question is, what are some other creative ways that foundations can be instrumental in having a local impact that is not direct funding? So for instance, many of our foundations have dedicated their work to serving communities of color.
Yes.
But many of us in this room receive their paycheck because of this work in these various communities. So I'm curious if there's any research or observations about foundations that have moved their banking to Black-owned banks to show the immediate impact. Because we know if any of our foundations would move to a Black-owned bank, immediately there would be more loan opportunities within the immediate community. So it would spread the impact that would extend outside of immediate grant making. So can you talk about that?
Yes, and you raised some really important and interesting strategies that I think philanthropy is taking. There's been a lot of research on ways to close the racial wealth gap. Philanthropy has been really interested in thinking about strategies that they can take to do that. And one of the things that was dispelled in the research around strategies to do that was around moving the finances to Black-owned banks and thinking about the capacity of those organizations to handle some of the philanthropic capital that we have. And what was presented as an alternative, though, was to build the capacity of the community development financial institutions, or CDFIs, in those places, and strengthen the partnerships that they have with Black-owned banks so that you can further the partnerships between those and so that people have more access to capital, all people of color have more access to capital if we have a more robust system of CDFIs. And if anyone's here from rural communities, you know there's sort of the patchwork of CDFI capacity that we have across the country. So there's so much that needs to be done in order to build that capacity up as well as with the Black-owned banks. But I think that's really helpful to think about that. And we've seen foundations really think about more than its grant making. This is the reason I brought up the impact investing side, really thinking about the rest of the capacity that it has on the investment side, and there's great actions happening toward that. But I think, though, voice and the kind of things that you're raising, and when philanthropy speaks up about the issues that they're seeing in communities and trying to challenge the rest of the systems in that community to take different action, is the key strategy that philanthropy can move forward. So thank you so much for that question.
So I had a question when I looked at the graph with the 5% and the 87%.
Yes.
Did you explore whether any of that was as a result of the concept of collective impact and backbone organizations?
Really good question around whether or not that was around backbone organizations, and it's not. That chart is really looking at the direct expenditures of organizations itself rather than sort of joined organizations or backbone. And a lot of the organizations that serve as backbone organizations community are not represented in that chart. So community foundations who tend to house funds for some of those and organizations that are created for that purpose, this is looking at those who are in health or human service and who are providing direct services. This is the spread of resources across those organizations. And so this is a reflection of the preferences of philanthropy in terms of who you give to. I started almost a decade ago trying to figure out if there was a theory of philanthropy giving and if you could find any patterns to that. And what I find is you all just pick the biggest, most well-resourced ones because it's a competitive environment. And actually, philanthropy doesn't choose any organizations that's very different than what local government chooses. And so there is also a little bit there, a crisis of how do you justify your distinction from government if you're also choosing and prioritizing the same organizations and activities that government does. Faith.
Hi, Sheena. So, you know, there was a slide that you have that we showed our board back in March that Osula and I were very excited about, where you showed how charitable giving is changing, including what people are doing when they pay for things. And so I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit.
Yes, on some of those patterns a little bit more. I know I wanted to show that, but my design folks and comms will not let me show that many moving parts on one slide. It is against their aesthetic. But we have those posters and everything available for you. But we've been really tracking the trends in charitable giving and trying to understand what are the new forms of giving to watch and where are we seeing more dynamic behavior. And I talked about a couple of those. Person-to-person giving is exploding, particularly around medical debt. I mean, this is where we are really seeing neighbor-to-neighbor going directly around that. And it says something still about people's access to health insurance and health insurance coverage, that they're turning so much to person-to-person giving for that. That's one part of the larger trend of crowdfunding that we're seeing an explosion in as well, especially with small dollar donations around that. But I think this key trend of moving away from charitable organizations toward political giving is also something that we really need to watch. It could be a part of the moment that we're in, that people are really feeling like they need to do something in response to the political environment, that they're a part of that. But this was still happening across different administrations where we've started to see this uptick in political giving. I think with people having a change in trust and in the institutions that they're trusting, that they just don't feel like charitable organizations are doing enough for them. They're saying, why do we need to give through that organization? When I have all these platforms, I can just do a Facebook thing directly, or I can give money directly. Why go through the nonprofit? And so nonprofits really do have to do a lot of work to demonstrate their impact as well in order to continue to attract those donors. I see two questions here.
What are your thoughts about capacity building along with leadership development of small nonprofits?
When we survey small nonprofits, this is what they say to us. Funders always come back to us with capacity building and leadership development. And what we need is resources. And they are aware of these changing trends that donors are moving away. Foundations are changing their strategies every 3 to 5 years, so they feel much more vulnerable even when they're depending on foundation resources. They don't see the landscape of individual giving being favorable to them. And so they're saying, we want resources. And what they're asking foundations to do is to help them attract more donors. Use those networks to say, here then is who I pass you off to next. Or here is how you're going to take something like a matching program and design your grant making so that they are introduced to other donors in their community who like the brand that you bring and the prestige and the expertise that you're bringing to back that organization. And so use that capital for them as a way of connecting their needs to those particular resources. There's a reason I said capacity building to help them be competitive through the process. They don't want general capacity building or leadership development anymore. They want you to trust them that they have the ideas to move. What they need is capacity to play in the arenas that you're playing in, and they want your help to elevate them throughout.
I wanted to ask for your thoughts on impact investing, Impact Chicago and Plaza 122. Those look like interesting initiatives, and the way you describe them makes them sound that way as well. I'm assuming that people get involved in that sort of are taking a long-term view of return. And those folks, I think it's fair to say, are out of the mainstream. That mainstream investing is really about short-term returns and really large returns as well. In order for impact investing to scale where it's going to make a real difference, what would you say about that short-term, long-term mentality? Do you have thoughts on that?
When we looked around the country at different models, especially in place-based impact investing, and a lot of the foundations who are doing this are either doing it through PRIs or MRIs and advancing them in that way. And that creates a little bit of the horizon that they get to work under. A lot of the deals that we saw moving were giving pretty reasonable returns. They're still in sort of the 5 to 6% return, but over within sort of a 3 to 4 year note-term horizon. In the field, that's how people are describing short-term, the sort of 3 to 4, 3 to 5 year horizon as a way of doing that. What we are seeing, though, is the kind of investments in the pipeline, though, where communities are coming with opportunities for that investment are requiring and are demanding much longer time horizons. We saw an example in New York where the time horizon for the capital was a 75-year note. I'm like, I don't think we could see that replicated in many other places to have that kind of capital staying there. And so we're trying to figure out in the field where you can find that happy medium that you're searching for. And I think as we get more models and more examples where foundations are really trying different ways to do this and are saying to each other and learning from each other around what's acceptable and are helping their boards see what's possible, that might get us to a point where we're able to have this, a different and more valuable discussion about this short-term versus long-term conversation.
I was really struck by what you've been saying about building the capacity to compete.
Yeah.
It also kind of makes me think about whether the competition is the right thing or kind of how we've set up the competition. And one of the things I get frustrated with is that, you know, I'd love to upend that system of competition, but I'm not also in a place of power, I think, to do that.
Yeah.
So kind of how do you deal with that tension between knowing that you want to enable your community partners and grantees to compete, but understanding maybe the moral argument that the competition is not necessarily the thing you should be enabling and
enforcing. Great question. Really great question. And this is a hard one, especially because when we move towards strategic philanthropy, many of us don't do RFP processes anymore, right? It's closed. We consider and we sort of find the partners that we think will be the best at implementing our strategy. And the sense there is that is sort of closed down a more democratic access and opportunities for organizations. And so the pendulum is switching, though. When we want to move from being more strategic in our philanthropy to being more equitable, it calls us to open up that process and to make it where people have the opportunity to compete. So we started with a competition as sort of the basis because that's part of the theory of greater equity in grant making. Now, how competition happens is really different. And it's not just sort of let the best person win, right? There can be developmental competition where you're asking people to put in their ideas and you're having a competition of ideas and not necessarily a competition across capacity and resource. And that's why having this idea of a LOI stage, or when we did some of our tests, all we asked for was a four-line idea statement. Like, what is it that you want to do? Only four lines. Nothing else was considered in the review process. So we looked at no capacity, no budgets, nothing. Still, when it was just those four lines of text, the more well-resourced organizations still won out. I mean, they can write those four lines so much more better that it was really difficult to get the money not being connected to those. It could be because it was around data, and data capacity is an issue around that, but that's something also to tease out. So I wouldn't throw competition out, but I would think about ways to make it a healthy capacity building kind of competition, because also the organizations need that, right? Like the way that we develop ideas, and I love to write grant proposals because it gives me the one time to be creative and innovative and really think hard around how I present the work that we're going to do. And so that process is really helpful in the sharpening of social innovation. And so we don't want to throw it out.
We have been a collaborator along with other foundations and corporations in place-based investing in Western New York. When we did all of our due diligence and thinking and planning, we thought that we would be investing in not-for-profits. Mm-hmm. And it turns out all of our initial investments have been in the for-profit sphere. And so I'm just wondering if you have a view on, is there something that needs to be done to cultivate a different kind of investment for not-for-profits to rely on? Something that might require them to spin off and have an equity model or to mm-hmm. take on debt as opposed to relying on grants and government funding?
We're seeing this in all of the models across the country, that the organizations who are stepping up that seem investment ready tend to be for-profit organizations that are ready to take advantage of those impact investments. And there is a bit of catching up that I think the nonprofit sector has to do. They've been so used to sort of building revenue as they go along, and debt has been such a negative in the way that foundations assess their financial performance. And so in a way, we've created the context where nonprofits are not quite as savvy and prepared to take on things like debt or create spinoffs where they can take equity in. And they want to know this. They want foundations who are doing impact investing to help them to figure out what do they need to do structurally to be investment ready in order to take in some of this impact investing capital. So thank you so much for that.
You point out the change in the pathway for donations into C4 organizations. Having been a legislator and worked in state government, for many people, they see that as a way to make their investments more sustainable by actually having governmental policy change.
Yes.
Rather than a 3, 5, 7-year donation path. Is there some thoughts about how you can work collaboratively with that and still maintain the ability to help deliver services?
Really good point. I think people are starting to see and are hungry for making the kind of impact. And as we're thinking about systems change, it's starting to push us toward giving toward policy change. And so we are seeing 501c4s and other mechanisms as a pathway to get there. But I do think that there's work that we can do to pair that kind of work along with our programmatic in order to sort of move them more along in sync rather than the way that we're saying we have our advocacy strategies over here and then we have our program strategies over here. There's a way to sort of bring those two together so that they can inform one another. And I think that's a really great recommendation to do that.
The slide that you showed where you were talking a little bit about the 87 and the rest.
Yes.
And then you were mentioning the leadership development that maybe smaller organizations get, but not always get the freedom to operate that they'd like.
Mm-hmm.
Made me think about general operating versus other kind of money and who gets what kind of money and
mm-hmm.
why. I was wondering if you could, if you've done work on that, share a
yes.
little bit.
Yes, thank you so much for that question. So we've been doing mapping of the kind of grants that go to which organizations. And the smaller organizations, we just put so much restriction on their funding. It's not even believable. And they're the ones who need the general operating support so that they can have a little bit more agility to figure out what they're doing and to change strategy as they're building it, as they're sort of flying the plane at the same time. We really strap them into one particular way of moving. And I think that's a little bit of the detriment to their ability to grow and find other ways of working. So really great point.
two different questions.
Yes.
One, fact or fallacy about the sheer number of nonprofits.
Yes.
Growing, not growing, the types that are growing, and what that might have an impact on.
Yes.
And second, going back to trends and who's giving, can you talk a little bit about just the faith of philanthropy? That has been hijacked to the detriment of folks thinking that, you know, communities of color are just asking rather than giving, when in fact there's a really strong tradition of giving, which ties also into the lack of diversity in the organizing, fundraising, development community.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And then can I just say, I'd throw another one in there?
For good measure, let's keep going.
Throw another one in there about gender, women. Women giving, how they give, who they give, driving giving, and family.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, this is so good. Okay, so I'll start with women, because the Women's Philanthropy Institute at Indiana University does incredible research on women's philanthropy, and they're a great partner of ours. And we've been learning some great things from their research. One of the most striking to me, which I think is interesting, we know women are the ones who are giving in the families. That if you can find, especially as a development professional, if you can find the woman, you have a faithful donor for a while. The thing that we're learning, though, is that they take a long time to get to that decision. And so, although when they do give, they are more generous, getting them on the pathway to giving takes a lot longer. And they're waiting until they're upper middle in the spectrum before they really see themselves as philanthropists. And young women just do not identify themselves as philanthropists. They feel like they have to store so much more and keep a reserve for the family, so they do not feel like they have the generosity to give. So that's one on the women philanthropy. On the nonprofit sector, keeps growing. I mean, we cannot stop nonprofits from starting up and moving along. So the startup rate in nonprofits is really, really high and has stayed high during the recession and continuing to climb. But the time cycle of life and death for nonprofits is starting to be much shorter. So we have a lot of entrepreneurial activity, people coming out of college saying, I want to start a nonprofit, and they're closed in 2 years, or they shrink down and we don't see them in the tax data anymore for after 2 years or so. So there's a lot more volatility in the nonprofit sector. And in terms of the identity of philanthropists and who is a philanthropist and what traditions we give through, I think a part of the narrative has been so much focused on the millionaire givers and the new wealth that we've turned our minds and our face away from things that are really growing that I think are positive in communities of color. Giving circles are expanding. I see you. And that people are starting to give through the Asian Women's Circle and all of these traditions who are coming back together and seeing giving as a social good. I think that's where we have some real positive trends, and that we want to invest in seeing giving move in that area. Final question.
A question related to equity in philanthropy.
Yes.
And the dollars going to specific communities, as philanthropy can certainly have a strategy to try to bring down the gap of that divide. Do you have any research of the dollars going specifically from a racial equity lens, specifically to particular communities?
We do, and we're starting to capture some of that. The difficulty is in the way that the data comes through the Foundation Center database. If you guys would tag your grants as racial equity, that'd be really helpful to researchers like me. But the scary thing is that through things like machine learning, we're sort of scraping your websites right now and taking your own language from your websites to figure out what you're actually doing. And that's giving us new, better data. Sorry to tell you about all the big data stuff we have going on. So protect your websites. We're scraping a lot from those. But using that kind of data and also the conversations through Twitter, we pull Twitter data down to figure out where conversations are happening in philanthropy, and then we catalog that on how much funding is going to these particular areas, and also how different foundations are defining racial equity work very differently. And I'm happy to share that with you.
And I'm wondering, do you have specific ways to track dollars going to specific communities? For example, what's the percentage going to Black and Brown, Asian, Native American communities across the country by philanthropy?
We do, and we use a proxy of location of organizations for that. And there are some interesting trends in terms of research. So one of the areas is that a lot of this research has been done in sort of LA County. And there is some interesting data, and I love to share it with you, where you can see as the percentage of African Americans in a community goes up, the amount of both government and philanthropic capital that they receive goes down steadily. The trend is that the communities that need that investment the most are the least likely to receive it. And what we're much more comfortable with is placing the dollar in a different community and saying, now open up a branch or have a mobile bus to go serve those other communities. But we're not placing the dollar in those communities. And there's some great research that's on that, on those points.
Thank you.
Perfect. Okay, and so my time is up. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.